Thank you, Steve. Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder. Steve, whenever you do news and there are emergency situations and it's mentioned in the news that a SWAT team has been called, I'm amazed at the talent of these individuals. And on the line with us right now, a 26-year veteran of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office in the Denver, Colorado area, retired as a sergeant, 17 years on the SWAT team, and he's written a book called Bullet Riddled. And Grant Whitus on the line with us. Hi, Grant.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We've been looking through the book Bullet Riddled, the first SWAT officer inside Columbine and beyond. Some pretty graphic pictures in this book. And, you know, I don't want to forget Columbine, but sometimes I forget some of the facts. I forgot that they had bombs that they made, the two boys involved. Why don't you refresh our memory and then say what you found when you arrived that day?
Sure. As you read it, obviously, it brings so many interesting new points that nobody ever had an idea because we'd never talked before then. But you're right. As we were going in, we knew there were several people shot and several bombs that went off. And even some of the teenagers, the students that were hurt, were hit with bomb fragments. So as we were going through the window, they broke the window and I got into the cafeteria area. I fully expected to be in a firefight. And even bombs to go off. So to be in a firefighter, we got the equipment for that. But we really weren't prepared to take on these bombs. I've never seen that prior to Columbine. And of course, now we've seen it in some of these other mass murders in the future.
Grant, at that stage, when you guys get the call to go in, you have no idea how many people you're up against, correct?
We don't. That's true. And it, like we read in the book, in hindsight, there's two, but when we went in, we thought we were fighting 7 to 9 of them. So it was so slow moving through there because every room we came to, we found, you know, 20 or 30 students. We had to evacuate them because we didn't want the bomb to go off and have everybody die. So it was just slow moving through the school. We got upstairs in the science room. We worked on the teacher until he died. And then, of course, the library was right across there. Not knowing, the most casualties were in the library. So I made entry in there. Actually, one girl was still alive we've never talked about, and she's never talked. And then I found the shooters in the back corner. The interesting part about that was, you know, that was just two of them. So we thought we still had 5 or 7 left to find. And it really didn't end until we cleared the whole school and there were no more.
When you think about it, first responders to things like this don't exactly know how many shooters or what's going on. And so a lot of times when you guys get there, the SWAT team, you're walking into it blindly, aren't you?
We did. You know, it gets so convoluted with so many people calling in and the different information that's given. Like Columbine, we had no idea if it was a library. You know, it was a science room. We had reports of them clear across the other side of the school. So that's why they were telling us we think there's 7 to 9 of them shooting in there. And every time there's something like this in a mass shooting, all the information is kind of similar to that. It's like we call it the fog of war because you don't really know what you're stepping into.
So, Grant, to what extent are you benefited by technology? Like in a situation, as time has gone on, now this was 17 years ago, so there was some...
Wow, 17 years already.
1999. So there was some cell phone usage. It wasn't like it is today where everybody has a cell phone, but how are you using that knowledge to help stop any kind of an aggravated situation?
Well, you know, it is worse today, like you said, because every student's got one and the phone calls come in like that. So, you know, it really is not a help to us other than we can kind of identify from which call and the noises that are coming in, meaning the shooting and where it's coming from and where that student might be. That's the only help. Now, it truly comes down to, you know, the weapons have gotten a little bit better. Certainly the ballistic shields and the bulletproof vests have gotten better. But you still need a group of men and the first responders to get a gun on and go inside there and get to work. And, you know, that's what's changed over Columbine and what we've taught over the last 17 years is you can't wait for SWAT to show up anymore. The first officers on scene, we teach the 1- and 2-man response. That means the first officer there is going through the door and he's engaging that shooter. No more waiting for SWAT.
What do you advise people that happen to be there? Like I think of the Pulse nightclub. I mean, if you see somebody shooting, What is your advice to just other civilians standing around? Do you try and take somebody down? Do you run for cover? Do you just assess the situation when it's happening and make up your mind?
Yeah, isn't that tough? What do I do? Because every circumstance is so different. But I teach the run, fight, hide model to all the schools and all the public places. And firstly, we want them out of there. If you can get out of there, run to find a safe place. Secondly, if you can't get out of there, you're on the second, third floor or beyond, prepare to fight. As they come through the door, we teach them to take them on and use code words amongst yourselves, but you got them. If you're in a school and other teachers can come help you, students can come help, but you're going to stop them once they come into your room. Because lastly, we teach that hide model. And if the, you know, if you've got a group of people hiding in a corner and he comes into that room, it's nothing more than sitting ducks like you saw in the library with Columbine. So that's the last model I teach. But now I'm telling everybody, be aware and fight for your life.
As you describe this, Sergeant Grant White is on the line with us. As you describe this about the three things that you should do, I'm just thinking of all of our kids in school right now, and I'm covered in goosebumps because it's like it shouldn't be like this.
No, you're right. It shouldn't. And if we look at it, and Columbine was just a stepping stone for all these major shootings that have happened since. Because, you know, we look into them and we've got the Sandy Hook and bigger shootings even happening up into, you know, like Virginia Tech where 32 people were shot. Now we've got the Florida incident. So Columbine was the first time that these cowards realized that they're going to get recognition for doing this. And statistically, it's a suicide mission anyway. So they want their name to live forever. And the bigger the shooting, the longer their name will live. And it's sick, actually.
So, Grant, that said, there's been a debate for the last several years that maybe we shouldn't report the names of the people involved in these shootings, the gunmen. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that it's our responsibility to say their names, or should their names not be mentioned?
I don't think their names should be mentioned. There's two ways to do it. Obviously, we got to quit saying who they are and putting out so much information, because the next sick guy says, hey, I can do it even better, I can do it even bigger, and my name will live on forever. And secondly, we've got to fight back. If these mass shootings stopped because we armed citizens and we armed, you know, teachers or a cafeteria aide or somebody that's actually going to carry a weapon and stop these shooters, they won't be successful and they'll quit doing them. But we're not doing that. If we look back to what just happened in Florida, certainly we don't want people carrying, drinking and carrying guns, but you know, if they weren't drinking, they had weapons, this drastically could have changed that night. And the law enforcement response in Florida was very similar to Columbine, and I spent 17 years trying to change that response. So that one was disheartening for me.
But see, now, we can get into a whole gun issue, but you are trained and have been specialty trained to be on the SWAT team. You're used to having a weapon. There are people that are around here that want a weapon that maybe shouldn't have one.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I look at my career. I've shot hundreds of thousands of rounds through guns, machine guns, and it's still hard when it really happens. I'm not going to lie to you. If you read the book, I've lost. I was very honest. I had failures, successes. I just kept getting back up on my feet even when something bad happened. And it's much harder than I can ever even explain in a book. But I want everyone to understand, law enforcement, military, EMS, that these bad things are going to happen to you. You have to get up the next day, and you have to go back to work and be better at it the next day than you were, and you'll survive it. It's just hard, and I think anybody has a weapon that's going to carry a concealed weapon here in Colorado. They're very easy to get, but I want them to train with that weapon, prepare with that weapon, and understand that they can't make a mistake with that weapon.
Grant Whitus is our guest. His book is called Bullet Riddled. He was the first SWAT officer inside Columbine. He tells that story and plenty of others. If you'd like to jump in, 312-981-7200. We'll be back after this. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
We are talking with Grant Whitus, retired sergeant, former SWAT member, 26-year veteran of the sheriff's office in the Denver, Colorado area, 17 years on SWAT. And here's the dumbest question of ever. What does SWAT stand for?
Special Weapons and Tactics.
I knew that because I used to watch SWAT.
Oh,
with
yeah.
Steve Forrest.
Oh, that's right.
And Robert Urich.
That's an old people thing, right?
Yep.
The book is called Bullet Riddled, the first SWAT officer inside Columbine and beyond. You go, there are some great pictures in this book and some pretty intense exercises that you guys use to train to be a SWAT member. It's pretty tough, isn't it?
It is. You know, truthfully, just to get on the SWAT team, we 8 out of 10 failed our physical side, our physical test. So
8 out of 10
might go to the oral board. I'm sorry.
8 out of 10 failed it.
They did. So the people getting on were coming back 2 and 3 times, trying to get back on, and we tested, you know, about once a year. So it was hard, and I wanted the best athletes and the best cops I could possibly get out of all these departments. And really, after Columbine, when I took over, the team really got fantastic. We knew what to train for physically and mentally by then. But still, after the Platte Canyon shooting, you know, 7 years later after Columbine, you know, I still lost team members just because of the PTSD they suffered through Platte Canyon, just like Columbine. It was unfortunate. I thought it prepared them better than that.
Grant, let's talk about that mental aspect for a minute. You went through Columbine and you saw some of the most gruesome things anyone could ever imagine. So how do you leave your work at home? That's impossible, isn't it?
It is. You know, looking back at it now, and you say, I dealt with it pretty well. I mean, certainly afterwards, if you read the book, we had conflicts inside. A few days later, I started fighting with a teammate. I got suspended. And then a year later, my wife left me. So obviously those effects are not something I could see, but they were certainly there. And, you know, I thought I dealt with them so well. The team actually fractured. I took over the team. The old guys left. And like I said, I rebuilt it. And, you know, and they just kept coming. Obviously, we had the Granby tank, as you see in there, another shooting with a guy named Grumpy Fred. So I put all these incidents in there. And the toll it took on even my young SWAT members, who I thought I prepared physically, mentally so well, was just the same as Columbine.
Well, I mean, people have to understand, as with a police officer and definitely a member of the SWAT team, I mean, your job is to take away the threat, but it's not like you wake up every morning hoping you're going to shoot someone.
Oh, no. You know, certainly most law enforcement officers never, ever shoot anybody in their career. You know, it's 99%. Now, some of them don't even pull their weapons. So, you know, it's rare, and all the things I were involved in was probably, you know, one of the rarest of all careers in law enforcement, that I went through 2 school shootings and an additional mass shooting. So, you know, I was unfortunate and fortunate, depending on how you look at it. I've had, since Columbine, I've been training law enforcement officers across the United States on how to deal with this and the mistakes we made at Columbine. And now we train them that first patrolman's got to be through the door and get to them quick. We can't allow them to keep doing what they do. And we can't allow what happened at Columbine to happen again.
Patrick is on the line, and he has a question for you. Patrick, this is retired Sergeant Grant Whitus. You had a question?
Yes, Sergeant. I'm a paramedic, and I'm wondering, do you feel nationwide we've done as much to get, as we need to get EMS to the victim's side as quickly as possible, considering that, you know, the majority of these people, other than suffering the head, you know, catastrophic head wounds, who tend to bleed out, and the ability to get there, get EMS to the scene, and get them as close to the patients and treat them as quickly as possible, has a significant impact on their survival rate. Do you think we're doing enough?
You know, Patrick, a great question, because obviously we're in Columbine, and you read in the book that, you know, we were with Mr. Saunders, the teacher, for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
EMS wouldn't come in because the scene was hot. You know, he ultimately died in my arms before EMS even got there. And then years later, we went through the Platte Canyon. By that time, I've had 2 medics. One was on vacation, and one was in the military and got sent back. So after Platte Canyon, I not only had the 2 medics, I had a doctor on my team. So in today's training, we incorporate EMS into SWAT and try to get them in there with the officers as quick as possible, because seconds matter inside these mass shootings.
And you have to understand, I mean, Patrick, you're an emergency, you're a ambulance driver, EMT, what is it called, EMS now?
Paramedic.
A paramedic. So you're not going to want to go into a scene if it hasn't been secured, so...
No, it's quite the opposite. If I was trained properly, if I was wearing a level 3 vest and a helmet, I would have absolutely no problem with it. I mean, everything we do is dangerous. But I mean, I would find it more frustrating to be sitting in a staging area looking at my watch, knowing that people are bleeding out.
You know, and not because, getting in there, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it doesn't take long. I mean, people, when you hear that phrase, bleed out, femoral artery will bleed out in a minute and a half. A brachial artery will bleed out in about 2.5-3 minutes. You don't have long. If you're shot in the chest, you know, you don't have long if you have a tension pneumothorax. You know, you need to be decompressed, and it has to happen now. So there's a lot of things that, and our skill set has changed so much that whereas before we would start an IV, now we literally use what's called an interosseous, where we would actually drill into the bone and secure an IV. We've learned so much from battlefield medicine, and you know, to be standing in the staging area waiting would be extremely frustrating. I would never hesitate to go in with the police.
Grant, is there someone Patrick can contact and become like part of a SWAT team medic or something?
You know, absolutely. And all, at least out here in Colorado, all the police departments are attaching medics to their law enforcement and training with them. So they're all going in together in these mass shootings. So it's very common out here, and I'm sure they have some kind of program put together there. So in his local police department, he should talk to them and see what they have together. And I bet if they don't have it now, they're working on it. If they're not, I'd be happy to talk to them about it.
There you go, Patrick.
All right, thank you very much.
Good luck, Patrick.
Thank you for your help.
Thanks. Grant, whenever an incident happens, like Columbine, you see experts on television saying, well, you know, video games are incredibly violent, and television shows and movies and rap music, and they all contribute. You've been a lot closer to this than any of us. Do you think all those things are contributing factors?
You know, I can't say anything about the music. However, we knew that the shooters in Columbine, you know, practiced on the computers doing what they did. And honestly, for two young men, they were very good at it. So that practice in some way did help them, absolutely. Would they have been a match for SWAT? Of course not. But, you know, like I said, now they're not fighting SWAT cops anymore. They're fighting the first patrolman that shows up and now has to go through the door. So, you know, I'm not a big fan of those video games. They'll never go away. I realize it's a financial thing, but I hate to see it, and I hate to see kids playing with them. I kept my son away from them. And, yeah, I think there was contributing factors in that.
All right, Grant, we don't have a lot of time, and yet I have a doozy of a question for you. But, you know, being one of the first responders several times in a place where you can carry a weapon, how do you determine who the shooter is when everyone in a situation is armed?
Well, you know, what we teach is statistically, we can only talk on statistics because every one of them obviously changes, is that you listen for the shooting. And that shooter is not hiding. So as they enter a place where there's a mass shooting going on, if you can't hear it, search for them room to room. As soon as you hear it, go to that room and make entry immediately. There's no negotiation. So that's how it's taught. There's nothing complex about it other than that statistically they're a suicidal mission. They're going to keep shooting until they're either shot or they kill themselves. So get to them quick.
It's we got this book in and we haven't had time to read it, and I can't wait to, because Bullet Riddled, the First SWAT Officer Inside Columbine and Beyond. Retired Sergeant Grant Whitus, thank you so much. Good luck on the book. Where can we get this?
You know, it's in Barnes & Noble, Amazon right now. It comes in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. And if your local store doesn't have it, just have them pick it up.
Thanks, Grant. Again, the book is called Bullet Riddled. What a story. We really appreciate you being here, Grant. The best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. All right, a quick break. Steve with the news, and then more show. It's Bill Leff, and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN.